So today I'll tell you about some examples and consequences of anomaly inflow. I'll try to connect the first lecture to the second lecture, and we'll start to get some more big picture consequences. So let's just recall the setup.
Sorry, there's a question in the chat about last time. So Yuvan asked why conformal symmetry is not included into the space-time and internal symmetry framework.
Well, I answered that last time, but I think that the nature of the conformal group changes between dimensions, so there's not really a satisfactory inflow picture for that. Okay. So in the notation we were using last time, we arrived at this kind of framework, where here we had an anomalous partition function. Here we had some invertible theory. Here we had a kind of nice gauge invariant object, fully invariant partition function. And I remind you that A were my background fields. And Y, the manifold here, has the property that the boundary of X, the boundary of Y is equal to X, which is space-time. So we have our anomalous theory on the boundary of an invertible theory. Okay, so let's try to see how the quantum mechanics examples that we talked about fit into this framework. So I'll try to sketch that out. So I'll be a bit more detailed on this example and a bit less detailed on the second. So, okay, what was our Lagrangian for the particle in the circle? 1/2 x dot squared plus theta over 2 pi x dot. So I remind you, x is the dynamical coordinate on the circle, and theta is the parameter parameterizing the different quantum mechanics that we're talking about. So it's a coupling constant. And we were most interested in theta equals 0 or pi, where the symmetry seen by the operators is O2. Okay, so if we want to try to see this example in this inflow framework, we first need to couple to background fields. So let's do that. So the background fields. So in the interest of simplicity, I'll do something a little bit easy, which is that I'll study just U1 inside O2. And then we'll try to see what happens to the C element, the reflection element, when we couple to backgrounds for this U1 subgroup of O2. Okay, so since it's U1, everything is easy, so we can write a connection A. We could just write it locally as A0 dt. Okay, so how do we promote this Lagrangian to a Lagrangian that depends, that couples to this background appropriately? So L becomes 1/2 x dot plus A0 squared plus theta over 2 pi x dot plus A0. And this part is kind of easy. What am I doing? Well, I'm trying to make it invariant under x goes to x minus lambda, and a naught goes to a naught plus d lambda dt. These are the relevant gauge transformations. Right, remember that under the u1, x was shifted. That's why it has this shift transformation. And now there's a kind of a little bit sneakier of a term, which you might not think about initially, is that you can add a term like this, where k is some integer. So what is this? This is like a 1D Chern-Simons term. So you think of the one-dimensional quantum mechanics manifold as a circle, then you're allowed to add a Chern-Simons term in one dimension, which would just be the holonomy of the gauge field weighted by an integer. Okay, so this action, or this Lagrangian, is just manifestly invariant under these transformations. So it's invariant under U1 gauge transformations on the nose, and this was true for all theta. We're only going to find something interesting if we now also investigate C, which we can only do at theta equals 0 and pi. C was the transformation that reflected x. Okay, so now let's ask, is it invariant? Well, is what we really want to know is e to the s invariant under C? C is the additional element that we need to get O2 from U1. So what is C supposed to do? Well, it's supposed to send x to minus x, and also, since it's reflecting in SO2, which is U1, it's also supposed to send A0 to minus A0. Okay, so there are two cases where we could check this. One case where we think everything's going to work out nicely is theta equals 0, and indeed we could verify that. So let's look at theta equals 0. In that case, we have just this formula. And this is invariant if we choose this kind of integer k to be 0. So we had a new term, this new term that didn't involve any x's that was allowed when we start turning on background fields. And we see that demanding invariance under C fixed the value of that term. Okay, everything's great at theta equals 0. Everything is more interesting at theta equals pi. Okay, so of course in this case, I'll write it like this, pi over 2 pi. We have this formula. And now I'll leave it as an exercise to see if you understand how this works. Show under C that you have the following transformation. E to the minus s, what appears in the path integral measure in Euclidean signature, transforms to e to the minus s times the exponential of I times 2k plus 1 times the holonomy of this field, this background field. So, in case the notation isn't clear here, S is the Euclidean action. And Euclidean time is compact. So in verifying this, you will need to keep track of the fact that this was a Lorentzian signature Lagrangian, and we need to put some I's on the time derivatives when you go to Euclidean signature. Okay, so that's the transformation property. What would it have meant for the theory to be exactly C invariant in the presence of this background field? So C invariance, well, that would, in the presence of this background field A, would have required that the exponentiated action goes to itself. So this kind of error term would have had to be zero. So that would have only been possible if 2k plus 1 was 0. And this is impossible because k has to be an integer. So unlike the case theta equals 0, where we saw that we could adjust this new term to make the theory C invariant, in the second case, when theta equals pi, we see that there is no choice of k that makes the theory C invariant when we couple to a background U1 connection. So let's make a comment about this. So I want you to notice that it is kind of falling into the pattern that I outlined last time. So this failure of C invariance in the presence of background this background connection, this is the anomaly. And what we wrote there was the anomalous phase. One times I times the holonomy of the gauge field. And this is indeed a classical phase. So last time we had a discussion about how in general the variation of the effective action, the kind of anomalous phase, would be a phase and would be proportional to the unit operator. All you would find is some local function of background fields. This is that in quantum mechanics, just some classical function of A. So this is, in quantum mechanics, the failure of the background gauge invariance by contact terms. Okay.
I'm just a little confused. I thought usually we stated this as like the failure for the action to be invariant under a gauge transformation. So
yeah, this is a special case of that because after I'm doing a kind of constant C gauge transformation. I'm inserting a C defect. That's a constant C transformation in the presence of this background U1, and I'm finding that it's not invariant. So this is a case of that.
Wait, so why should I think of this as a, like, is this like a C defect somehow? Or like a...
Yes, I did see. I tried to see if the action was invariant under a C transformation. Yeah.
Yep. Hey. Sorry, the K cannot be integer because...
K
cannot be half integer because the integral of the gauge transformation can be take any integer value. But you could like declare that your gauge group is a bit smaller and impose that the holonomies of the gauge transformation are always even. So you are reducing the gauge group, and then k can take half integer values.
Yes, there are various different options at this point. That's sort of related to going to the double cover, what you just said. But I will show you the other option, which is using the inflow. So keeping the periodicity of A the same, keeping the group O2, but coupling to some invertible theory in one higher dimension to fix this problem. Okay, so what's the inflow viewpoint here? So we'll extend S1, the Euclidean time manifold, to be the boundary of some y. And of course, we'll also extend A into y. And what do we want to write? So we're going to define a new partition function, what I keep calling z tilde of A. Which is the partition function of the anomalous theory times the following. So here F is the curvature of the gauge field. So this is an invertible theory. If y had empty boundary, then this theory is just minus 1 to the C1, the first Turing class of this bundle. So you can now verify. So maybe if it's not transparent, you should verify that z tilde of A is C invariant. So that's the particle on the circle viewed in this inflow picture. You can do something quite analogous for any projective representation. Let me just sketch that out. Okay, imagine for simplicity you have a finite symmetry, say, G. So it acts linearly on operators. But projectively on states. Okay, well then there's a cocycle characterizing this phenomenon. We could call it mu. Sorry, it's a cohomology class in the second group cohomology with coefficients in U1. Actually, let me R mod Z. Okay, so how do you, in this general situation, you can also write down an inflow action. And it's pretty clear how to do that. So we need a background field. So we view a background field A. It's a discrete gauge field for this finite symmetry G. So what kind of mathematical object is that? Well, it's gauge equivalence class. I'll write it like this. Is in H1 of space-time with coefficients in G. And we can view this as a map from space-time to the classifying space, BG. So it's a homotopy class of maps. And then if you pick one of them, you can pull it back. You can pull back this cocycle. What kind of mathematical object is that? Well, that's in H2 of space-time with coefficients in R mod Z. And that is exactly the kind of object that you need to define a simple invertible theory. So the associated invertible theory would be in this notation, e to the 2 pi I integral over y of a star of mu. So, for many of you, that will be straightforward if you've seen this before. If you haven't, let me give you an exercise just to make sure you're following. Let me call this equation star. So let's let z2x denote the shift symmetry, the z2 shift symmetry that sends x to x plus pi in the particle on the circle. So that's a shift by half the period. And of course, we also have z2c, the z2 symmetry generated by charge conjugation, by x to minus x, this reflection. So this is the symmetry, for instance, preserved by this cosine 2x potential that I told you about. And what you would like to do is, what I would like you to do is unpack this equation star for g equals z2x times z2c in the particle on the circle. Okay, so this is what I want to say about projective representations in quantum mechanics and the particle in the circle and how that fits into this big paradigm of anomaly inflow, where you have an anomalous theory on the boundary of an invertible theory. Any questions? Okay, well, if not, then I'll quickly go through the second example. And the second example is richer. To really get into the details would take much more time, but I'll kind of sketch things out for you. So let's talk about these T-invariant fermions. This is another quantum mechanics example. So we had real fermions. I called them psi I. And they were quantized as a Clifford algebra with canonical anti-commutation relations. And I went from 1 to n, so we had n of them. And we saw that T invariants implied that we had a degenerate ground state unless n equals 0 mod 8. So I'd like to present or show you how this theory could be the boundary of some invertible theory. And I'll give you two kind of perspectives on that. I'll sketch them out. One is kind of very formal, but at least states the answer quickly in a language that some of you will understand. And the other is a more physical picture. So we're talking about a space-time symmetry here, time reversal. So the kind of background field that I was, the background field viewpoint is that we're talking about a certain class of manifolds. And we'd like to understand what class of manifolds, what class of two manifolds, are we allowed to put this theory on? And, sorry, what class of two manifolds are we looking for the invertible theory? So the invertible theory will be on some kind of two manifolds. So if you recall, in this problem, t squared to 1, and this, I claim, tells you that the manifolds that we're looking at should have a pin-minus structure. And for those of you who remember the difference between pin-plus and pin-minus, this is not a typo. I really mean pin-minus. Now, why is that? Well, there's a kind of subtlety with Wick rotation here. So T, when you say T, that's a Lorentzian signature concept, time reversal. And if you want to get to a Euclidean manifold, you need to do a Wick rotation. And then you'll pick up a pesky I in the time direction. So you will change what happens here. So after Wick rotation, this leads to reflection squared is minus 1 to the f. That's why in Lorentzian signature, if you have a symmetry structure where t squared is 1, you actually, when you're thinking about inflow in Euclidean signature, want to be thinking about manifolds with a pin-minus structure. Now, for those of you who haven't seen this before, you may kind of not know what it means to have a pin-minus structure. So let me just make a little table, which when I was learning this, I found very helpful. Let's talk about some possible structures that we could put on manifolds. And these structures can be summarized in terms of the allowed behaviors of W1 and W2. So what are W1 and W2? These are the first and second Stiefel-Whitney classes of the tangent bundle. So here, W1 is in H1 of whatever our space-time relevant space-time is with coefficients in Z2. W2 is in the second group. These are the Stiefel-Whitney classes. Okay, so kind of easiest structure you might imagine. Well, I'll label them in terms of the structure group that you might try to put on the tangent bundle or a lift of the tangent bundle. So you could have an SO structure group, and that means that W1 is forced to be 0, but W2 could be anything. You could have an orthogonal group on the as the structure group, and then W1 could be anything, and W2 could be anything. Okay, for spin, we can keep going. Then in this case, both have to be 0. We have a spin structure. Now we get to pin plus and pin minus, these double covers that we're interested in when we have both fermions and a reflection symmetry. So for pin plus, W1 can be anything, but W2 is 0. And finally, for pin minus, W1 can be anything, but W2 is restricted, and it's equal to W1 cup W1. So in this problem, we're looking for invertible theories that can be defined on two manifolds. That's one higher dimension than our quantum mechanics. And the two manifolds are supposed to have a pin-minus structure. So an interesting fact is that if you have a closed two-manifold, let's call it Y, then there's a nice relation that W2 is equal to Euler mod 2 which is also equal to W1, cup W1. So in fact, any such Y has a pin minus structure. Okay, again, an exercise. Some of you will have done this, some of you will have not. Let's call this star star. So prove star star. And maybe a follow-up question, which two manifolds admit pin plus structure? Okay, so coming back to our kind of main interest, we're looking for an invertible theory that characterizes the anomaly in multiple real fermions in quantum mechanics. And this invertible theory should be some kind of widget which takes as input a pin minus manifold, pin minus two manifold. So let me give you an abstract description, kind of state the answer, and then I'll give you the more physical picture of why that might be the case. Okay, so the two-dimensional pin minus Bordism group is omega 2 pin minus, which is Z8. And the generator here is RP2. So here's a mathematical fact for you. So an invertible theory we could think of it as some object that assigns to a closed two-manifold phase. And it should do so in a manner compatible with Bordism. So for this kind of symmetry structure, we have that the possible invertible theories, we could think of their partition functions as just being homomorphisms from this Bordism group to U1. So a kind of Pontryagin dual group. Of course, this is, again, isomorphic to Z8. And the generator here has a famous name. I won't go into the details of this, but just to say it, it's this ABK, R. Brown, Kevare, and Marion of the associated quadratic form. So given a pin minus structure, you get a refinement of the intersection pairing from which gives you a quadratic form, and there's a formula that gives you this homomorphism. Okay, so that gives you kind of an abstract picture of what the possible invertible theories are with this symmetry structure. And now what's the statement, what's the relation to the fermions? So the main kind of result is that for n real fermions with T squared equals 1 symmetry, the anomaly theory is n times the generator inside this cobordism group. So I'm not proving that for you, but I'm stating it as a result for those of you who have seen invertible theories in kind of a different framework, maybe a more mathematical framework. This is maybe a more palatable way of thinking about things. Now, what's the physical picture? Let me try to sketch that out. This physical picture is due to Kitaev and Fitkowski. So let's consider N, same N, but now 2D real, also known as Majorana. Again, you know Majorana has made it as a physicist because his name starts with a lowercase letter. So we could call them, say, chi I, these fermions. And we could write a Lagrangian for them, a two-dimensional Lagrangian, which would be something like I chi d slash chi, so a standard kinetic term, and then a mass, chi L, chi R. So here L and R are denoting the two different chiralities. So a two-dimensional real non-chiral Majorana fermion has both left movers and right movers. And importantly, once you have that, there is a mass term that is permitted that couples them. Okay, so the main point is that this model is T-invariant with the mass. So exercise check. So unlike the case of the 1D real fermions, where T obstructed a mass, here, with the 2D real fermions, T permits a mass. So why am I introducing this? Well, I wanted to get you something which kind of naturally had a boundary, which was these N real fermions. And now I'm in that setup. I have 2D fermions. And so if I have a two manifold with boundary, well, on a manifold with boundary, I would impose that the left and right movers get identified. So this is restricted to the boundary. And these would become my boundary fermion, psi I. So this setup, where you have n two-dimensional Majorana fermions, naturally has a boundary state, which is these n real quantum mechanics fermions. It also has a mass. This is crucial. Now, this is true for any m, so we can ask, what happens for large m? Right, we were trying to study a theory, where, a kind of paradigm, where on the boundary you have something interesting and rich, some anomalous theory, and in the bulk, in one dimension higher, you have something very simple, an invertible theory. Here, I haven't achieved that yet, because I have, in two dimensions, I have these kind of fluctuating fermion fields, but they have a mass, and I can drive their mass off to infinity and make them not fluctuate anymore. So for large M, or equivalently very low energies, pies are very massive. And hence, at long distances, their partition function is described by an invertible theory. So what that means, so just in general, the limit as the magnitude of the mass goes to infinity of z chi of y is invertible. This is a suitable eta invariant. Maybe just as a remark, it is generally true that if you have the long distance limit of a trivially gapped system, the effective action is invertible. We're using that here. So just to conclude, in case it is not clear, what have I produced for you by taking the mass to infinity? I have produced for you a direct construction of an invertible theory, in this case, that suitable eta invariant that I was a bit sketchy on, with boundary the n size. In fact, for a single such Majorana fermion, this is not obvious at all, but for a single, well, maybe it's obvious to Dan, for a single Majorana fermion, the invertible theory that you get from this low energy limit of the partition function again generates the cobordism group. So this is another way of seeing that mod 8 phenomenon. Okay, that's all I want to say about the specific examples, fitting them into the paradigm of inflow. There's obviously a lot more to say about this example, but I'd like to move on to another topic. So let me take some questions.
Is this a very general principle that there's some relationship between massive things in one dimension and massless things in one dimension lower?
Not necessarily massless. So the general principle is that if you have some quantum field theory, in this case it was two dimensions, but if you have quantum field theory, which where everything can get a mass, so you could tune things to lift everything from the spectrum, then the partition function of that theory at long distances is an invertible theory.
So if I'm given like some massless free fermion theory and I want to find the corresponding bulk thing,
the first guess might be the same type of field in one higher dimension. That's a good guess, and then you could try to give those things mass and try to make them bulk invertible.
Okay, so it's a first guess. Okay, yeah. Thanks.
Sorry, is it true that for any invertible theory, there is a lower dimensional theory which is anomalous with this anomaly?
I think the answer is kind of tautologically yes. You can sort of pick whatever structure you would need to trivialize the invertible theory and then try to make that fluctuate on the boundary. I think the answer is yes. I'm not sure that's exactly a proof, but I think the answer is yes.
Thank you.
There's another question in the chat. To describe anomalies, why do we need a TFT? It means a functor from Bohr to Vect instead of something more limited that is defined only for mapping tori or mapping cylinders.
This question came up in the end of the discussion last time as well. I think the question is, the kind of old-fashioned way that I presented anomalies, I motivated them by considering gauge transformations where I would have an invertible theory on a mapping torus. And now you could ask, well, what if my invertible theory vanishes on all mapping tori? Does that define a good anomaly or not? And I think physicists were confused about that for a very long time. But this problem seems to have been settled in the sense in that invertible theories that vanish on mapping tori still define interesting anomalies, and they still have the consequences of the that I'm going to tell you about. So in a sense, the old-fashioned point of view where you looked at mapping tori was not sufficiently general. The better, kind of a more modern starting point would be to say that an anomaly is an invertible theory. And that's kind of our working point of view now.
Yeah, I have a question. So, like, so on the, okay, so on a manifold boundary, right, the Majorana fermion just restrict to the original ones we saw in the 0 plus 1D system. So why doesn't the mass term in the bulk give a mass on the boundary?
Because chi left becomes equal to chi right, and because of Grassmann statistics, that's just zero.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions, let's exit the realm of the kind of specific examples and go on to some general consequences. Okay, so for the last part, I will tell you about general consequences of anomalies. So the theme here, kind of slogan, is that anomalies protect kind of non-triviality, and I'll try to unpack this a bit, of families of QFTs. So these are families that are related by continuous deformations. Again, I'll also unpack this. So, but they're, what kind of continuous deformations are they? They're continuous deformations that preserve the symmetry type. So they preserve the possible background fields that we could turn on. What kind of continuous deformations might I have in mind? So one is you could dial a coupling constant. So for instance, in the quantum mechanics examples, that was changing some kind of potential. Or a coefficient of a four-Fermi interaction. That's an example of changing a coupling constant, as long as the operator multiplying that coupling constant doesn't break the symmetry type, doesn't remove any of the symmetries, then this is an allowed continuous deformation. It's not obvious, but an important case of this is that you can also add massive fields. In condensed matter, these are sometimes called spectators. So, you know, you could change the field content of your theory by bringing down from infinity some massive fields. So you can imagine there are some additional massive degrees of freedom that start their life with mass equals infinity, and then I dial their mass down from infinity. And as long as I bring them down in a symmetry-preserving way, in a way that preserves the symmetry type, this is an allowed continuous deformation. To begin with, those fields may not couple to the initial fields, but then I can change coupling constants and make them interact. The final one that I would like to highlight, again, it's kind of a special case of these, but we should highlight, is renormalization group flows. Often you think of these as being triggered by an operator, so in that case, I would need to have them be triggered by a symmetry preserving operator. And again, you can think that RG flow is kind of a combination of these operations and its inverse. You're removing, as you go down in energy, you remove massive degrees of freedom and the coupling constants change. So in a sense, RG flow is in this other bullet points. So that's what we're talking about when we say continuous deformations. Yeah.
In the first case, are you including also like moving in possible moduli space of Agua?
Yes.
Okay.
That's more like this case. No, you don't change, when you move in a moduli space of vacua, you don't change coupling constants, you change the vacuum state. The ultraviolet Lagrangian stays the same, but an operator develops an expectation value. It's not an RG flow triggered by an operator. So this is not the only way of making an RG flow. It's an RG flow triggered by a vacuum. So, okay, let's denote by lambda some kind of parameter. On a family of the type that you can make in this way. So then we can again write our inflow schematic. But now, everything in this equation will begin to depend on lambda. So, the partition function of the anomalous theory will depend on lambda. The invertible theory may start to depend on lambda. And consequently, this also depends on lambda. So, here, omega lambda in my notation is like the Lagrangian for a family of invertible theories. And we'll denote by equivalence class of omega lambda the deformation class. So that means anything that's continuously connected to, say, the initial value of omega. And tautologically, this equivalence class, this deformation class of the invertible theory, is an invariant of the family. So omega lambda was, this equivalence class was just, by definition, everything that you can get by any continuous variation of the invertible theory. And so therefore, that's stable in the family. Now, this is powerful. Why? Well, often, omega is characterized by discrete data. For instance, a level or an element of a cobordism group that is a torsion. And when that happens, you can always conclude that this is not zero. So there will be just no continuous path connecting such a omega characterized by discrete data to the trivial element. And just a warning about sloppiness. Sometimes physicists do not make a clear distinction between the invertible theory and its deformation class. And sometimes the word anomaly is used to mean one or the other. So just to hammer this point home, for the examples in quantum mechanics that we talked about, it was the case that the invertible theory was characterized by discrete data. There is no path connecting those to the trivial element. Well, maybe that should be an exercise. In some cases, that's immediate. In other cases, it takes a bit more thought. Okay, so now we get to, with this setup, we get to the kind of key point, and I'll just take about 5 more minutes to state this key point. Called anomaly matching. So if you have z lambda of A, this is the anomalous theory, the boundary theory. So it was a boundary of the invertible theory characterized by omega lambda. So now, if the deformation class of omega lambda is not equal to zero, then the boundary theory cannot be invertible anywhere in the family. So whatever this is, we're often interested in figuring out the dynamics of this boundary theory. It's not a topological theory. We don't know what it is. But we know that if this deformation class is non-zero, this boundary theory must be such that it reproduces that deformation class. And in particular, that obstructs the theory from being invertible, because an invertible theory does not need an extension to one higher dimension. It has trivial omega lambda. Let me unpack this a bit for RG flow, just to that's the one of the key examples. So in that case, you want to take lambda, this family's parameter, to be a distance scale. So we could think lambda equals zero is the short distance ultraviolet, lambda equals infinity is the long distance infrared. And you could characterize possible infrared behaviors of relativistic QFTs via their mass gap. So what are the possibilities? Possibility one is that it's gapless. That means massless fields. Or more general, interacting CFT, non-trivial conformal field theory. Possibility two is that it's gapped. By this we mean all particles have mass. And then in that case, there's sort of two possibilities. One is really a special case of the other. We can call them sort of 2A, in which case you have a topological quantum field theory. And then there's possibility 2B, which is really a special case of 2A. You could have a topological invertible theory. And this, of course, is a special case of this. And if the deformation class of the anomaly theory is non-zero, then 2B is impossible. So this is the sense in which a non-trivial anomaly protects the non-degeneracy of the ground state. It tells you that at long distances in quantum field theory or at low energies in quantum mechanics, you cannot be in this case. You're non-trivial in some way. Either you have some massless field or some CFT, or you have a non-trivial topological field theory. It's not invertible. Okay, so that's what I wanted to tell you today. So I'll stop. Okay, everybody's in a state of confusion, so I succeeded.
Okay.
Well, I'll be around, so if there are no questions, you can find me.
Thanks, play again for the nice lecture.